happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
He washed our sins away.
Oh, happy day.
Happy day.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you. Today, the latest on health and healing, all kinds of good information, including why you should not take antibiotics for coughs, but what you should take instead. Also, we're going to look at CAT scans and how they're providing a lot of damage to the body, and most people are not aware of it. I'll give you the real risks of CAT scans. And also, modern parenting may hinder brain development, the research shows. So what are we doing wrong as parents today? And for the health risks of obesity, according to the latest study, the average American is just clueless, doesn't understand what happens when they're overweight. The foremost, well, I would say four drinks I would never consume. The energy drinks, I'll tell you about them. But what you could consume as an energy drink that's healthy, that's health and nutrition from the environment. Trees grown for biofuel, that's good. No, it's not. I'll explain how. Biofuel is the wrong approach. It's not really what we should be doing. And why? Also, the latest report just in this morning, sea level rises will be much worse than we feared, say 26 of the world's leading scientists in this important report, with, quote, tens of millions likely driven from their homes. And there's a new mathematical tool they're using to determine how bad this melting will be. And for those of you who thought that Australia was the right place to go, it's the hottest place to go. Yesterday, Australia had the hottest day in its history. In fact, so hot is it now in Australia, and fires so rampant that one entire town was just burned out, burned to the ground, right at the ocean. People had to run out onto a pier in order to not be burned and watch as all their homes were destroyed. It is so hot in Australia that they've had to come up with a new chart and a whole new rating for heat. That's how hot it is. Now for the bad news. That's the new norm. It's going to get a lot hotter, making Australia virtually uninhabitable in the future for most people in most places. Also today, I'm going to have my guests who were recently fired, nurses who refused to take the flu shot, Suzanne Schrock and Joyce Gingrich. They're from the Goshen Hospital in Indiana. They were among a group of 15 that were fired, but there have been dozens fired across the country. We're going to talk with them, and then we're going to talk, if we can reach him in Rome, Italy, Dr. Tom Jefferson. He is one of the world's leading scientists, and he's with the Cochrane Database Collaboration, which is the really high-end, ultimate gold standard scientific review group in the world. They don't play politics. They can't be bought. And he's going to tell you what their research found about the flu vaccine, its safety and efficacy. Today, by the end of this program, we will have posted on my Facebook page for the thousands there, the GaryNull.com and ProgressiveRadarNetwork.com, the latest article that has the newest science showing you the safety and efficacy of the flu vaccine. For many people, you'll be shocked. Also today, I'm going to start by looking at our state of fear. More than ever before, we are motivated by what politicians and talking heads and ideologues tell us we should be fearful of. For example, we should be fearful of terrorists. And so they create a war on terror. And then we pay for it. And we pay astronomical amounts. Are we safer? It's a reasonable question. Now, since there's a limited or finite amount of money that they can spend, if they're spending a disproportionate amount of money on the war on terror, they're taking it away from other areas. As a result, we now have a new internal terror going on in the United States that no one is talking about. We will. Large cities all over America are degenerating into gang-infested war zones. Now, they don't have a problem with guns. 1,500,000 new members of gangs in the United States, a 40% increase since 2009. I predict that it will double in the next 24 months. So what's that mean? It means that, well, they don't have a problem having guns. But if we continue to condemn people who do, or try to ban guns, then what's it going to do for all the people who are decent, ethical, honest, and innocent people who then become victims? You want a registry? You want to have a newspaper do something really stupid and irresponsible by putting the addresses and information and names of all the people who in Connecticut who have owned guns? Why don't you put a list of all the criminals, gang members, organized crime figures who have guns? Oh, I forgot. They don't register, right? So the people who are really the ones we should watch, you don't have any record of them. And those who haven't done anything wrong merely want to protect themselves and their families. So I'm going to deal with this today. And I'm going to share some facts that, unfortunately for many people on the left, may confuse them. They get confused easily. But I'll tell you what really is killing the most people. So I decided to go to the FBI, and I decided to get the actual latest statistics. I'll share that with you. And then I'm going to talk about what's happening to our cities and what happens when America descends into deception and tyranny and the agenda prevailing over the truth. This is the beginning of a series of commentaries I've written that will then segue into Naomi Wolf revealing how the FBI coordinated crackdown on the Occupy movement and Chris Hedges on the state of fear that it is creating, and from Thomas Harrington how liberals shirk responsibility for atrocious policies by their leaders. And that leads into former advisor, quote, "Obama is ruthless and indifferent to the rule of law as Bush. Americans are unaware of the scale of the drone program and the destruction it has caused in their name." And John Brennan's extremism and dishonesty, and what happens when a person lies, what happens when a person supports rendition and torture. Well, of course, in this administration, Obama appoints him to run the CIA. Where's the outcry? Well, there is none. Corporate Democrats don't cry out. And then we have to look carefully. The war on terror. It can never end, and they know it. Now, I won't get to all this today. It's not possible. I want to show you what's coming this week. And as I unravel each piece of this, I'm going to the underlying basis. Who profits from our fear? Who profits from keeping us so paranoid, so delusional, that we act more like a Jim Jones cult member than we do rational, reasonable, independent-thinking people who can make responsible decisions? I'll give you their names, which organizations that they belong to. I will do an in-depth commentary on ALEC that controls virtually all of our state legislatures and our laws. I'll show you, I'm going to pull back the curtains this week to show you the real power behind the scenes. Serious stuff? You bet. Want simplistic stuff? Sorry, that's not our agenda. But this is the stuff that we need to know. Let's begin. There was an interesting find in a shipwreck. It was a 2,000-year-old shipwreck. And what'd they find? Well, some Italian scientist looked into what was found in a shipwreck off the coast of Tuscany, and they found zinc supplements were blended with animal and plant lipids and pine resins and are believed to be the oldest ever found. The beeswax and the charcoal and the starches and the olive oil and the wheat were all blended, and then they were put into metal tins, which are oxygen-free, and that's how they were found non-decomposed. It was around 130 to 140 B.C. Quote, the results of this work highlights the continuity up to current days in the use of zinc carbonate for the treatment of human diseases, especially in dermatological and ophthalmic fields, said the chief of archaeological heritage in the research. So why is this important? And these studies are being presented at the National Academy of Sciences because it shows that throughout history, people cared about their health and used what was in nature, plants mainly, and herbs and resins, and honey was always used. It is the oldest, most commonly used medicine in history. They knew if you pack a wound with honey and bee propolis, it can help prevent the spread of infection. And cuts, scrapes, burns. They knew if you put the resins of like aloe on, it could help soothe the pain. In the tropics, they knew that if you took green, immature coconut and you took the gel, because if you open up a coconut today, it's brown and it's hard and you have a white pulp in it. But if you take a coconut when it's immature, it's green and it's soft and inside it looks like kind of a clear jello. But there's water in there. Well, that water is extremely beneficial. It's a highly alkalized water. It's loaded with potassium and other minerals, but the gel is extremely soothing. They use it for dysentery, parasites, worms, indigestion, and topically for all kinds of insect bites and burns and the like. So we have to give people historically credit. It's just we didn't know it went back that far in that area, and it did. Many people are unaware of the risks of CAT scan radiation scans. This is from Ginevra Pittman from Reuters, and I'll quote this part of it. One-third of people getting a CAT scan did not know the test exposed their body to radiation. That's in a new study from a medical center. Researchers found the majority of patients also underestimated the amount of radiation delivered by the CAT scan, and just 1 in 20 believed the scan would increase their chance of ever getting cancer. And the study's lead researcher, Janet Busey, said doctors need to do a better job of talking to patients about the risks and benefits of tests, including about radiation exposure. So that's bad news. Now, I've done several reports on the dangers of CAT scan, and one full-body CAT scan gives you more than one full lifetime exposure to radiation and definitely will cause cancer at some point if you live long enough. And that's based upon the research of Dr. John Goffman, one of the co-discoverers of plutonium and the medical doctor and scientist who is the leading authority on low-level radiation. And he told me that any radiation in your life will cause cancer at some point later in your life. But a CAT scan is a lot of radiation. Let me also mention that those working around radiation are also at higher risk. If you're told that no problem, there's no risk at all, that's wrong. All the airline travelers who are getting that radiation exposure, especially frequent flyers, you're really putting yourself right in harm's way for cancer. Also true for pilots and flight attendants and others that go through that on a daily basis. doctors are simply not fully aware of how dangerous the CAT scans are themselves. I wish they were. There's an interesting article that we posted up on our website on how dangerous the CAT scans really are and the real proof that they can cause cancer. So I suggest you read that. Now, right now, when people are getting coughs, a lot of them are going to rush off and get an antibiotic. Well, that's their right. But there's a lot of research, including published in the peer-reviewed journal The Lancet, that shows the coughs that often accompany the flu or mild chest infections are not to be treated with antibiotics. And as more research is done regarding so-called non-traditional healthcare, doctors and scientists are rediscovering some of the historical treatments that can help us. About 2,000 patients across 12 European countries were tasked with keeping an illness journal. This according to the BBC. And researchers from the University of Southampton, led by Professor Little, found that the severity and duration of symptoms in those who were treated with antibiotics were no different than those who took a placebo. Experts said, however, that if pneumonia was suspected, patients should still be treated with antibiotics because of the severity of the condition. Antibiotic effectiveness has been reduced because of overprescribing. Quote, using the antibiotic amoxicillin to treat respiratory infections in patients not suspected of having pneumonia is not likely to help and could be harmful, end quote. Quote, overuse of antibiotics dominated by primary care prescribing, particularly when they are ineffective, can lead to the development of resistance and have side effects like diarrhea, rash, and vomiting. Our results show that people get better on their own. But given that a small number of patients will benefit from antibiotics, the challenge remains to identify those individuals. Now, we are simply overusing antibiotics. So what could you use if you're coming down with a cough, a sore throat, cold, or the flu? Several things. The top of my list would be stop overworking, turn off the television, and get yourself some quality rest. Taking a really hot sauna, fully hydrating yourself, getting a lot of potassium into your body through coconut water. Drink one quart of coconut water, and then take a really good throughout a day, and then take yourself a sauna. That's good. If you don't have a sauna, a hot bath with Epsom salts. That's good. Taking about 8 glasses of vegetable juice a day. But 2 of those won't be vegetable, they'll be fruit. One will be watermelon with lemon. The other will be grapefruit, lemon, and lime. It'll be a little pungent because you're going to use the skin and seed. But take Manuka honey, 1 teaspoon, which is very medicinal. Kills off bacteria and viruses in your throat and your stomach. And then take as much vitamin C as you can handle orally. Best to take it in buffered form. And also best to put a banana, some almond or cashew, natural raw nut butter into a blender with some avocado and some rice milk or almond milk, and then spike that with vitamin C. How much you would like over a day. Let's say it's 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 milligrams. Take a half that amount in quercetin. Now, then you throw all that in a blender and you blend it. Let's say you blend a quart. Then you take small cups of that, maybe 3 ounces, 4 ounces, every time you want to take your vitamin C. What that will do is that will allow a higher percentage of the vitamin C to get into your blood because it's not straight vitamin C hitting hydrochloric acid in the stomach causing acid reflux and diarrhea. So by buffering your vitamin C in a smoothie, your body can handle a whole lot more of it, and that's what you want. Also make sure that when you feel yourself coming down with a cold or congestion, that you take 1 teaspoon of black cumin oil twice a day. It's a great all-around anti-inflammatory. 100 milligrams of echinacea, 100 milligrams of astragalus, 100 milligrams of Pau D'Arco, Pau D'Arco, D-A-R-C-O. It's great as a natural antibiotic. Now, this is a little tough to take because it really tastes bad and it's very sticky. But real pure bee propolis is outstanding. It is nature's natural antibiotic. I would also suggest colloidal silver, wild oregano oil, cinnamon oil, and olive leaf extract. Eat as much of the miso soup that you can and put a lot of shiitake mushrooms, shallots, into the soup. And I wouldn't have tofu, I would just have that, the mushrooms and the shallots in the miso soup, maybe twice a day. So between the soups and the shakes and the juices, and the other juices should be various combinations of your green juice, always starting with celery and cucumber as your diluting agent, then you'll give your body the power to stimulate its natural immune resistance and your natural killer cell activity and your natural responders to viruses and the flu. Also, separately, from a New Delhi Knight Rider, they're talking about nuts. And this is from a physician. Here's what he said. Quote, I'm sure you must have heard, quote, I'm sure I must have some Turkish blood in me. I use my any excuse to munch on a handful of seeds and nuts at any time of the day. My patients know me as the doctor who prescribes almonds as a must for the breakfast menu or a snack. Nuts, depending upon the variety, contain important nutrients, including B vitamins, protein, and fiber. In fact, nuts are the richest source of protein in the animal or in the plant kingdom, so they're perfect for vegetarians to include in their daily diet plan. Archaeological evidence suggests that tree nuts, such as almonds, cashews, pecans, pine nuts, walnuts, were a major part of the human diet. Rich in energy and loaded with nutrients, nuts are rich in the omega-3 fatty acids like walnuts and peanuts, and they're essential to the evolution of the human brain. Several studies have noted that consumption of tree nuts, despite their significant fat content, decreases the risk of cardiovascular disease, obesity, diabetes, cancer, even Parkinson's disease. Make sure to have your nuts raw and unsalted. And pine nuts are great for you. They're at the top of the list. So, good news, have the nuts. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health nutrition. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Nall. By the way, we normally end our program at 55 minutes after the hour. However, I generally continue on, taking calls from people in the audience and even with guests or commentary. If you'd like to continue listening, or if you live on the East Coast and just West Coast and want to hear the program at its normal noon time, and it's 9 your time and you're not by your computer, you can use the telephone. The telephone number is 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066. And I want to thank all the cab drivers and truck drivers and people all over North America and Canada who every day just dial up and listen over the telephone. Now, from our environmental segment today, this is a study. And from Common Dreams, Beth Brogan, and says, trees grown for biofuel damage the ozone. Biofuels could also have detrimental effects on air quality. I'll quote just a paragraph. Fast-growing trees cultivated to produce biofuel are contributing to, not mitigating against, the looming catastrophe of climate change, according to a new study in the journal Nature Climate Change. Biofuels are often pushed by their advocates as a more friendly alternative to fossil fuel. But Critics have long said that turning industrialized crops into fuels is rife with unintended consequences and part of a failed strategy for slowing global warming and climate change. In this latest study, which looks specifically at fast-growing trees used for biofuel, poplar, willow, and eucalyptus, scientists found that such species release high levels of the chemical isoprene into the air as they grow. And this chemical, when mixed with other pollutants in sunlight, forms toxic ozone and can affect crop yields. Quote, growing biofuels is thought to be a good thing because it reduces the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Yeah. But what we're saying is, that's great, but biofuels could also have detrimental effects on air quality, and then it does. And here's my thoughts on this. There are some biofuels that could be used, like algaes. But more often than not, when we're using any form of biofuel, we're taking away land that could be used for growing food for humans. And because the profit is in the production and frequently the subsidies by the governments, and then what happens is feeding human beings doesn't become a priority. Feeding their bank accounts does. And now we're seeing that not only is it not economical, it's not even ecological. Let's focus our energy on wave energy, geothermal, solar. Those are the ones most likely to liberate us. Now, you know I've been talking about why I believe that we should do the right thing. Now, of course, doing the right thing is not always doing the politically right thing. I believe that we should take an honest look at what is the likelihood that all the homes being rebuilt where Hurricane Sandy has destroyed them on the water, what is the likelihood that that's going to happen all over again and even worse? It's absolutely a certainty this is going to get worse because this was a small storm by what's coming, simply because all the science, and I mean all the science, shows the more water's going in the ocean, and there's only one ocean in the world. There's not the Atlantic Ocean, Pacific Ocean, the Indian Ocean, the Arctic Ocean. Now, there's one body of water. So when the melting is occurring at the rapid rate that it is, and it's unprecedented, and it's going to get even more so, then you're going to have one of those bad days when no one expected such an enormous amount of ice to break and go in or skid into the water. You're also going to have the warming of the ocean, which means you're going to automatically have higher intensity storms. So instead of a tropical storm, it'll be a category 2 or 3. So why not simply look at where people could be housed that would give them a quality of life and have the government and the insurance industries and others work with them to create, you know, beautiful living environments? That makes more sense. Because what are you going to say to the people after they spend all year rebuilding and then it happens all over again? And then it happens again and again and again and again. So we're not looking down the road because we're thinking about people not wanting to move, people feeling, you know, that this is their place. And indeed it is. But no one's going to win against nature. That's not going to happen. Also, New York State alone has over 1 million square feet of unoccupied office space. Why not start a major conversion program using skilled labor at a living wage to put people back to work to convert that into nice living space? Because these are at least in safer environments. These buildings are not going to be blown down. And you could then put your emergency generators on the roof. You could even put solar panels on the roof. You could use green building materials. So it's not as if we have to go out to the country to do this. We're just not using our assets the way we should. That's just a thought. Now, here's the latest news from the Daily Mail, Lewis Smith, and I'll quote this. Sea level rises will be much worse than we feared, say leading scientists, with tens of millions likely to be driven from their homes. Among 200 million people or almost 200 million people, could be forced to leave their homes because of sea level rises. Sea level rises are now feared to be significantly worse than forecast by the Intergovernment Panel of Climate Change just 6 years ago. Melting of the polar sea ice sheets could be so severe that the seas could rise a meter, a level that would be considered catastrophic. The latest findings were made by a specially selected team of 26 leading experts who concluded the risks were, quote, potentially severe, end quote, after being asked to assess what sea level rises could be expected. It is most likely, they found, that there will be an increase in the levels substantial. Well, you already had the Maldives that are going to be completely gone, and then you have Bangladesh, which is always flooded, but now it's going to be even worse. But we're talking about the major cities. Quote, many big cities, including New York City and London, have river or coastal ports, and even small rises significantly boost the risk of flooding from storms and tidal surges. Flooding and the threat of inundation is likely, concluded the team, to force up to 187 million people to leave their homes. And then it goes on from there. So I'm merely giving you the news that you should pay careful attention, because if we don't, we could be in trouble. Now to our commentary. I'll only do one commentary. And we're trying to reach our guest. As soon as our guest is available, we'll go to Dr. Thomas Jefferson and the nurses. Here are the facts, whether we like them or not. According to the FBI annual crime statistic, the number of murders committed annually with hammers and clubs far outnumbers the number of murders committed with a rifle. Now, that's particularly important because a lot of people, led by Dianne Feinstein of California and Joe Manchin from West Virginia, are focusing upon the guns. And the idea is if we took the guns away from everyone, then we wouldn't have all these murders. Well, you're never going to get the guns away from the criminals. There was recently a very good documentary. I originally saw it on Current and TV, and it showed how guns of every type are banned in Mexico, but in just one single storage facility, they had over 10,000 firearms confiscated just at the border. That's just one. And they have these all over Mexico. And these all came from the United States. So criminals have no trouble getting guns. And no, they don't register. And we have no background on them. So the number of murders committed with a rifle were 445. While the number of murders committed with hammers and clubs was 605. Big difference. That was in 1 year. Then another year, 2006, the number of murders committed with a rifle was 438. The numbers committed with the hammers and clubs was 618. And so it goes. For example, in 2011, there were 323 murders committed with a rifle, 496 committed with hammers and clubs. So then that does not include the violence against children, which is just phenomenal, of how many children are killed by physical abuse, mainly fists, punching children. Most were under the age of four, and killing them. This is from a report from West Middlesex University Hospital. It said violent crime is on the increase, and kitchen knives are used in many as half of all stabbings. Hence, they're arguing that based upon people committing impulsively, quote, prompted by alcohol and drugs, and a kitchen knife often makes all too available a weapon. This was published in the British Medical Journal. So what are they suggesting? They're suggesting that doctors want knives banned. They're asking for the large kitchen knives to ban them. Okay, so you ban the large kitchen knives. And that means then what? You still have baseball bats, you still have hammers, you still have your fists. So we're going to end up having to register all of our fists, photograph them, getting DNA prints. Why aren't we looking at the truth of any of this? Why aren't we looking at the fact that we are a society that is addicted? Most of the people committing violent crimes against others are on psychiatric medication. All of the killers, all of them, 100%, have been on psychiatric drugs. Why is there not a word discussing this? What are they afraid of? Why aren't they talking about the nature of poverty? What happens in broken families? They're not addressing that either as a cause. They've made it an overly simplistic argument. Am I against assault weapons? You bet. Am I against people having the right to own handguns and rifles? I am not. Now to this, and then we'll go to our guest. I want to share insights of what I see is happening, because when I travel around the United States to do my newest documentary, which will be out next year, or this year, on Poverty Inc., I'm looking at what is happening in former pristine suburban areas and in beautiful urban and suburban and rural areas. And what I'm seeing is a decay, a rot, an abuse, a neglect that is not mentioned anywhere in the mainstream media. Economic Collapse blog has nailed it. Large U.S. cities that the rest of us and the rest of the world used to envy for being the right place to live are now gang-infested hellholes with skyrocketing crime rates. Chicago, Detroit, Camden, East St. Louis, New Orleans, and Oakland were once bustling with economic activity. But as industry has fled these communities, poverty has exploded. And with poverty, you're going to have an increased criminal activity. Meanwhile, financial problems have caused all these cities to significantly reduce their police forces. Sadly, the same pattern is being repeated in hundreds of communities all over the nation. The mainstream media loves to focus on mass shooters such as Adam Lanza. But the reality is that gang violence is far greater of a problem in the United States than mass shooters will ever be. Let me just give you the numbers. According to the FBI, there's 1.4 million gang members right now living in the United States. That's up 40% in the last 3 years. I believe it will double in the next 2 years. There are also several factors fueling this trend. Unemployment among young people is at an epidemic level. About one out of every three U.S. children lives in a home without a father. And there are millions of young men who have come into this country illegally and have no way to legally support themselves once they arrive in our cities. Gangs provide a support system, a feeling of community, and a sense of purpose for many young people. Unfortunately, most of these gangs use violence and crime to achieve their goals, and they are taking over communities all across America. If your community is not a gang-infested war zone yet, consider yourself lucky, because it will be. If nothing else is done about this, the violence and the crime that is fueled by these gangs will continue to spread, and eventually nearly every single community in the United States will be affected. But I just want to give you a few close-up examples. In East St. Louis, it has the potential reputation, or the national reputation, of being the city that nobody wants to go to. This is from a Bloomberg article, quote, about the growing crime. Dodging open manholes where thieves have swiped cast iron covers, Stephen Wigington drives the crumbling streets of his hometown, East St. Louis, Illinois, pointing out new landmarks in America's most violent city. There's the shopping mall where a police officer was shot in the face, a youth center that saw a triple homicide in September, and scattered about the city, 27,000 are brightly lit gas stations that serve as magnets for carjackers, hit-and-run robbers, and killers. It's the Wild West, says Wigington, and he's the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Illinois. Today, the murder rate in East St. Louis is 1,700% higher than the national average. But financial problems have forced the city into cutbacks on the police. The number of police patrolling the streets of East St. Louis is down 33%. Police in the city admit that they're outgunned and outmanned, but there's not much that can be done about it. Camden, New Jersey, that I've tried to help, but without success. Even the fetid little bureaucracy wouldn't even allow me to take over a block on my own dime and my own time and try to convert it and show how community participation could revive a city, to de-ghettoize it. But Camden, New Jersey, is another city that's experienced huge cuts in police budget. Their police force shrank by a third in the last 2 years. Today, Cannon is considered to be one of the most dangerous cities in America and has a murder rate that is 1,000% higher than New York City. The gangs have a strong hold over Cannon, and the kids kill kids on a regular basis there. But where did you see that? You didn't. Let me give you one excerpt. Quote, at the vigil last week, residents prayed that Cannon would simply find peace and the masked gunman who killed Jewel Manry and Khalil Gibson would be caught. As it grew darker, Michael Benjamin stood toward the back of the crowd. His son huddled even closer now and shook his head. Dad, I've known at least 45 kids who've been killed in my lifetime, he said, the boy holding up his finger. I stopped counting several years ago, though. How many kids do you know can say that they have known 45 kids who were killed by violence? You can't. And yet, nobody reported on it. That didn't seem to get anyone's attention. In Chicago, in recent years, there's been a massive cuts in police budget due to financial difficulty, and the murder rate in Chicago is 17% higher than it was a year before. And it's now considered, quote, the deadliest global city. If you can believe it, the number of murders in Chicago this past year was roughly equivalent to the number of murders in the entire country of Japan this past year. And the primary reason for all this? Gangs. How many gangs are there, members in Chicago? 100,000 gang members live in Chicago. 80% of all the murders and shootings in the city of Chicago are gang-related. And the gangs are growing in size and violence. And the same is true in Detroit and in New Orleans and in Oakland. And that's the way it is. And in Stockton. And that's the way it is. This is just one story. This is a woman, a single parent, and she found that, quote, just recently the city attorney of San Bernardino, California, told citizens living there to, quote, lock their doors and load their guns, unquote, because a police force in that city has been cut back again. And that was good advice. As the economy continues to decline, as millions more Americans fall into poverty, the violence is going to get worse. What would you do if a desperate criminal broke into your house and started searching through your home room by room? That's the horrifying situation that one young mother down in Georgia was recently faced with. Quote, she quickly retreated to an attic crawl space with the children, but not before she also picked up her handgun. The burglar, whom police identified as Paul Alley Slater, did a room-by-room search of the home, and when he searched the attic, she was ready. Walton County Sheriff Joe Chapman told WSB-TV the perpetrator opened the door. Of course, at that time, he's staring right at her and her two children, and she had a revolver. She reportedly fired, missed most, but hit once, and he went down on the floor. Then she said, keep your face down, and I won't shoot again. And he was arrested. What would you have done? What would you imagine would have happened had she not had a capacity to defend herself? She was not the criminal. But we're not willing to have that conversation, are we? I'm Gary Knoll. More to come on this, but let's go now. My guests are now on the phone. Let's begin by saying hello to Dr. Thomas Jefferson. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Hi. Jefferson.
Hello, Gary.
Hi. Dr. Jefferson is a former primary care physician from the UK who is now a leading investigator for infectious disease research at the Cochrane Database Collaboration in Rome. And he is the editor of their acute respiratory infectious group and the coordinator of the vaccine field, which reviews existing peer review vaccine research and determines the accuracy and validity of scientific methodology used and the claims being made. And he was also an editorial board member of the journal Vaccine. And Dr. Jefferson, our biggest concern today is that we have been led to believe that everyone beyond the age of 6 months should be receiving an annual flu vaccination. We've been told that these vaccines are safe and effective for everyone. Then we have an honest look at the literature. Here is my question. Can we say with certainty, based upon good science, independent science, and a gold standard, that would include safety and efficacy for pregnant women, for women who might be taking chemotherapy or may be on heart medications and statins, or people with impaired immune systems, or people on antipsychotic or antidepressant medications, or the old, or people who are senior citizens in nursing homes, in hospices, in hospitals, people who are suffering from diabetes and are on medications. Can we say that all those people will be safe and actually find efficacy and prevent the flu vaccine? That's what we've been told, and I just want to know, because you've taken the time to look for the truth.
Thank you very much for hosting me on your show, Gary. You've asked me about 15 questions in one, so let me just start from the first one, pregnant women. When you're talking about pregnant women, you're, of course, not just talking about pregnant women. You're talking about a pregnant woman and the fetus, the unborn baby. Now, a pregnant woman is a healthy adult, despite desperate attempts and transforming pregnancy into a deadly disease. Pregnancy is a physiological state. It is the reason why our race is still on the planet. So there's nothing wrong with pregnancy. It is normal. Pregnant women, therefore, are healthy adults. And we do know what the performance of inactivated influenza vaccines is in healthy adults, because there are quite a number of trials, clinical trials, that's experiments. We summarize them. And to give you some idea, you need to vaccinate about 33 to 99 people to avoid one set of influenza symptoms. The harm side, the safety side, is understudied. So it's very difficult to actually give you an accurate breakdown of the potential risk of the vaccine. There's the potential risk to the mother, there's the potential risk to the unborn baby, and there's the potential risk to the certain risk to the taxpayer. And that's something else which should not be forgotten. There are very, very few studies on pregnant women, and none of them are high quality. So I was taught at medical school that the less you do to pregnant women, the better it is. This goes, of course, contrary to modern medicine, if you like, which is more and more interventional and more preventive, between inverted commas. As far as the effects on the fetus are concerned of the vaccine, the second person which is involved in this equation, I would be very, very cautious about vaccinating unborn babies, even with dead vaccines like these ones. Of course, live vaccines is out of the question for an unborn baby. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Is it also the case that when they are testing a vaccine, should they also not have pregnant women and all the women with different diseases that would be required to take the vaccine included in the vaccine study, since when I read the literature, I saw that they were excluding the very people who would later be included in using it? To me, that is a contradiction.
It doesn't necessarily have to be a contradiction, because experiments, trials, are quite artificial in the way they're carried out. Some of them, if well carried out, are the perfect experiment. And in there lies some of the weakness of the design, of that particular design of a study, in as much as the more you select the population, the less the results are applicable to the real population, so-called reference population. So some public health bodies have turned to commissioning what they call real-life studies, or studies on real-life data. These are almost certainly observational studies. The vast majority are observational studies. The difference between a trial and an observational study is that in the trial, the researcher decides who gets the vaccine and who doesn't, or who gets the vaccine and gets the control. In the observational study, that decision has already been made. The observational study, therefore, is probably closer to reality. The only problem with that is that the design itself is a carrier of problems. It is very, very difficult to have good, well-designed, prospective observational studies. And we do know that studies carried out in the United States in the 90s, huge database-based studies, which showed that influenza vaccines affect influenza, affect deathfall causes, for instance, were so biased as to give the wrong answer, as to give an answer which was completely implausible. So we have to be very careful. In general, I think that the answer lies in designing better trials prospectively and enrolling significant populations. But these trials cost money, and of course you have the problem that as the decisions have already been made on evidence which is of very low quality, what bodies like CDC say is it is unethical to carry out trials now.
How do we actually know, unless we have two groups of people, let's say 5,000 people who have not had the vaccine and 5,000 cross-matched who do have the vaccine and then do regular workup on them, whether there's really efficacy? Because rarely do they use a non-vaccinated group against a vaccinated group. More often not, they use one vaccine against another, and they often say it's a placebo, and then we find out that the placebo is not a sugar pill. There was actually active ingredients in the placebo, and yet you wouldn't have known that from your physician or nurse or hospital or pharmacist or the CDC or the FDA. It's only when you take away all of the promotion and you look at the actual hard beginning data that there are these flaws, and most people are not aware that these flaws exist. Your thoughts?
Well, I entirely agree. We published in 2009, we published a review of 270 of these studies, and we found that only 5% were reliable, had a reliable design, and were reliably carried out. We also found that studies which have been funded by industry were more likely to be published on prestigious journals. That, for your listeners, means cited more and more in the public eye compared to other studies which have not been funded by the pharmaceutical industry. But these studies funded by the pharmaceutical industry on influenza vaccines were not better quality, nor were they larger. So there must have been another reason why medical journals found them irresistible, which had got nothing to do with the design or the results or the size of the study.
Also, if there are almost 200 different infectious organisms that can cause flu-like symptoms, and there's no standardized testing and proper diagnosis for people when they go to the doctor or clinic to be treated for flu-like illness, then what are we to make of all the warnings given about the seriousness of a particular flu season, and also the World Health Organization's record for predicting which strains of flu should be used in a given year's flu vaccine is rather dismal? And then there are studies such as a Danish study that those receiving a seasonal flu vaccine in 2009 were more likely to get infected with swine flu, and Canadian studies by Shokenrocksky seem to confirm this same finding. So even the predictions of the flu strains are frequently inaccurate, and what good is the vaccine against other flu strains not in the formulation?
The trademark of influenza and all acute respiratory infections, let's call it influenza-like illness, is its unpredictability. That's where the name comes from. It comes from the influenza degli astri, which is Italian for influence of the planet, because in the Middle Ages, they could not understand why these local epidemics came and went. They're mainly benign, they're self-limiting, they last a few days, and they're unpredictable. There's a very, very long and complex literature reporting, for instance, what happened in the year of the French Revolution, which I believe is also the inauguration of George Washington, 1789. There were two outbreaks, one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast, which happened almost synchronously, like springing up mushrooms. Now, you can't blame that on air travel, because in 1789, there was no air travel. It is an understudied, the real science behind this is understudied. It is covered in dogma, it's covered in public health marketing, and it's covered really in poor science, as you've pointed out. Very difficult to find good quality research in this area. It is not an easy area to research, of course, and the influenza vaccine mutates its coat, changes its coat very frequently, so it's a running target. Influenza virus. It's a running target. It changes. And you're quite right. Clinically, it is impossible to tell an influenza-like illness, what you call the flu, caused by influenza virus, from that caused by any of the other agents. Bear in mind, Gary, that also some studies show that almost 40% of these episodes have no recognizable cause. So that may mean that they're caused by microorganisms, which we cannot culture, we cannot grow, or we cannot recognize, or are unknown, or they may not even be infectious. They may be stress-related. So it's a completely understudied area, the good science of it. The bad science part, well, there's tons of bad studies out there that show whatever they want to show.
Well, I appreciate you coming on and sharing this insight with us today, and we really support all of your good efforts because you and your group over in Rome and Italy, you're not motivated by money that you get from pharmaceutical industries. You just tell us the truth, and what you're telling us gives us a reason for pause and to demand more independent, quality scientific research before people in the public health sector tell us to take our flu vaccine, it's safe and effective and will prevent the flu, when they do not have the absolute scientific integrity on their side to prove their point. And so we need good science, which is substantially lacking. Thank you very much, Dr. Tom Jefferson, being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Gary Nall. One final thought on this. When you look at the hundreds and hundreds of studies and articles pertaining to wild influenza infection and the flu vaccine, it appears like an elaborate, endless labyrinth of conflicting information and science. For example, for almost a decade now, the official U.S. Health Agency stance has been something like 36,000 deaths due to flu annually. But Peter Doshi, when he was at Harvard, debunked this figure. Of course, this figure is bogus because the CDC lumps together flu and pneumonia deaths under the same grouping, and we know that accurate diagnosis with PCR for an organism that might have been the cause of death is rarely, if ever, performed. Yet the 36,000 death figure is quoted repeatedly. Even the CDC's own rationale behind this figure is nonsensical, and still the agency propagandizes it every year in its PR whip pitch to encourage citizens to get the flu shot. In short, when it comes to flu vaccine science, whether the vaccine is effective or even safe in some age groups, such as very young children and infants, it's almost impossible to know the truth. And so, As someone who has looked at both the science to support flu vaccine efficacy as well as the public relations to push more flu vaccination, you just heard Professor or Dr. Jefferson say 95% of all the science was flawed. That means only 5 was accurate. So much for the truth about the flu vaccines. I'm Gary Nall. Let's now go to an extended version. I want to say hello to two nurses standing by, Suzanne Schrock and Joyce Gingrich. They were fired from Goshen Hospital in Indiana for refusing to take the flu vaccine that was being mandated for healthcare workers at medical facilities. Suzanne has been a nurse since 1970, working in pediatrics, orthopedics, and medical surgery, where she's a unit manager. And she has a great concern on this. And Joyce has been a nurse for 27 years and for the past 6 years has been an oncology nurse at Goshen Hospital inpatient unit. Nice to have you both with us today.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
What is the latest status? Why did you two choose and the other nurses choose not to vaccinate, even though you knew and were warned it could cost you your job?
I personally believe that the flu vaccine has a lot more side effects and is less effective than the PR that's out there, and I have a very strong opinion, as you know, personal conviction as to my own rights as to what I can put in my body. And I don't feel like a employer should have to mandate that I put something in my body that I feel is harmful.
And I would feel the same way. It is a drug that we should not be forced to take if we don't want it. We don't feel like that's what our body needs, and we're doing other things to keep ourselves healthy. Mm-hmm. So this was a deep conviction for me as well, and I still feel that way. I felt that way a year ago when they first came out and said this may possibly be mandated. So I knew then that by now they would either have to accept an exemption or let me go. So.
All right. Are you familiar with the toxicological data from the immunological journals on the mercury that has been used in flu vaccines and at 24 micrograms per in shot, and what that does to your neurons in your brain?
I have done a little bit of study on that, on just the fact that mercury in general is not good to put in your body, and that's also a choice. I mean, that was also one of the reasons I made that choice, to not put it in my body.
What is
now,
your,
one of the,
yes,
one of the things they told us was that there were no preservatives in it. That's the way they got a lot of people to take it. No preservatives, and it's single dose, and so therefore it's, you know, even safer than what they had thought, than what these people were portraying. But there is formaldehyde in it. That's a preservative, and they weren't forthcoming with that. There's also, as I understand, aluminum and a lot of other things, but the aluminum's not good for our neurological brains either, and causes a lot of those neurological issues.
As is polysorbate 80. We will have an article posted today on all the things that are wrong with the flu vaccine and the current flu. That is on our website. Also on my website, go to Gary Nall TV, and you will see three videos of my testifying under oath before a group of health experts on the health of the H1N1 flu and the flu vaccines that was going to be mandated in New York State. It's a 22-minute testimony I gave, and I'm being challenged by the doctors. Look to see the arguments I gave, the scientific literature I gave them, and you can use that information to strengthen your cause. Mm-hmm. And I believe that by knowing that the facts that they have known in advance that their vaccines are not effective for given individuals, mm-hmm. that there is a way of challenging the law on this.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that you work with those lawyers who will look at the actual science and not be bullied because there is a indemnification to the vaccine makers, and what's in the state law that was put there by Alec, and I'm dealing with this later this week, is automatic. If you can show at any point in any mandated law, national or state, that there was fraud or deception in the process of creating the product or service, then you have opened a door to strip away their indemnification and hold them personally and legally responsible. So you do have a capacity for class action depending upon what the research shows, and we believe that we have more than compelling research mm-hmm. to show malice aforethought and fraud.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for that information, because we do have a lawyer that's been fighting the flu vaccines and has gotten a lot of nurses off, actually. We just were the unfortunate few that didn't get that privilege of getting exemptions.
Well, I will continue to send you information, and please continue to keep us posted because you represent the canary in the coal mine for all the nurses, holistic nurses around the United States who are facing the same dilemma. And if they don't know the facts and the truth and the science, then they will be fired without recourse, and we want there to be a recourse.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure.
Mm-hmm. All right?
Definitely.
Are you represented by a union?
No,
we're not.
Okay. Well, both Suzanne Schrock and Joyce Gingrich, stand up to them. All right? They're wrong. You have truth on your side. You have real science on your side. And didn't you hear what Thomas Jefferson, the world's most knowledgeable person on vaccines? There's no one who knows more than you just heard the man from Italy.
Yes.
All right.
That was great.
And we will be posting his articles on our site today, including one from Alliance for Human Research showing, quote, scientists conclude flu shots, quote, overpromoted and overhyped and don't have the efficacy. It's all up there. All right.
Well, we know that. And yeah.
All the best to you and your efforts.
All right. Thank you so much,
Gary.
Bye. I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. And I want to say thank you to all of you who've taken the time to listen. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead, who's standing by. Hi, Utrice.
Hello. Hello, Gary. Today we're talking about a new program that's a new reality show called Paul's Gone Wild.
Well, good. All right. I would
like...
Go ahead.
No, this... crazy politics going on in Washington, D.C. You must think there's something in the air or in the water or something, but people seem to be going crazy down there.
All right. Well, they are. They're crazy to begin with. We have the worst human beings in the world that we give the most power in the world to. How smart are we?
Good question.
We are the ones who empower them. Remember, before anyone gets into this supercilious and completely moronic notion that there's 1% that are the devils and 99% are on the angels, ask yourself, how did the 1% get power? By allowing we, the 99%, to never question the fast foods that we eat that they own, the clothes we wear that were made by slave labor, never question our obesity in our children, our diabetes, adult diabetes in children. Never question the fact that we have a school system that is creating illiterates. Never question the fact that we have allowed, as I said earlier, gangs to become proliferate and are the major killers in society. And yet we put all of our energy into foolish drone strikes around the world in a war on terror when we are allowing the war against Americans from the inner city rot and ghettoization of America to occur without ever addressing any of the true underlying causes of poverty and inequality and racism. We won't touch that with a 10-foot pole, but we have unlimited bank account money to give in fighting these stupid wars. And so when I ask a person, are you against the 1%? You bet. Then let me look in your wallet. Gee whiz, you've got Bank America card. You got Citigroup card. You took a loan out using their company, and they're going to charge you 19%, but they're going to tell you on their commercial, they're giving you back 1% cash back with their blue card, but you're giving them 19%. So you get 1%, they get 19%. How smart is that? So when I look at how they maintain their power, it's only because we're willing to give our power to them. Take back the power to make intelligent choices, then 1% no longer have it over us. Look forward to your show, Utrice.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks a lot.